there's a movement happening. Some call it Reformation. Others call it Holy Discontent. We call it the Resistance. Traditions and harmful teachings have kept the bride captive for centuries. We will explore these systems and contrast them with God's design. Join us as we discuss God's patterns for life, ministry, and most importantly, His church. We will do this with scripture, testimony, music, and satire. We are resisting the system and embracing the design. We are the Resistance.
Jason?
Yep.
Mark?
Yep.
Mark? And I'm Terry.
Oh, I thought you were going
to
tell me
Welcome to the show. No, I'm not going to tell you anything. We're going to talk, you know, about just silly stuff for a while. So what's new with everybody? Anything new we want to share with the listeners? Nothing? I got all kinds of really interesting new stuff that I want to share with the listeners. This is my Fright Fest night, okay?
I was going to say, any new stuff basically just makes me really angry, so I'm not going
to
talk about it.
I don't want to get into the political thing and all the stuff that's happening with the police and the protesters. It's just too close to home for me, you know? And it's like, man, I just... Anyway, but I do want to talk about some really weird stuff that's going on. Do you know that we have mutant lice in Missouri and Illinois now? Mutant lice that are resistant to every treatment that's normally given for lice. They cannot be killed. Do you know what that's going to do?
Did they crossbreed with water bears?
They might have. The tardigrade lice are, but they're much larger, which means they could take over the world.
It's a good thing I memorized all of those cooties remedies when I was in grade school.
But none of them work.
They do.
Not on mutant lice.
I don't have mutant head lice.
That you know of.
That's right.
They're invisible.
I checked.
The other thing is, isn't it great to know that bubonic plague is making a comeback?
Mm-hmm. Man, reunion tour 2015.
Revival.
Yosemite campground shut down because they've had more than one case of bubonic plague come out of there. It's amazing. You know?
Didn't that wipe out a third of Europe one time? Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was a third of the known world at the time.
Third of the known,
known world, which I love when people say that. It's like, it wasn't really a third. It was just a third we knew about. There was all these other natives living
there. Apparently, nobody else knew about anything.
Yeah.
They didn't know their world.
The whole Western Hemisphere was unaffected, but it didn't count.
Right.
Just this one
just
little
Just the British
continent,
knew about it.
You know, and that's where we were at, so that's what we care about. What else? Oh, Ebola in New York. Suspected case of Ebola in New York. How's that happen? How do we end up being the place that ends up with Ebola whenever it was an Eastern Hemisphere thing, right? Africa, isolated there. Now we're on jet planes and bringing it home and treating people. And guess what? Here it is.
Yeah.
Wonder what that's going to do for us. I think that'll help our tourism industry.
Been here a couple times the past year.
Oh, the other thing is bird flu now. They're worried that it's going to mutate and transmit to humans.
Hmm.
Do you guys realize that you're paying twice as much for eggs because the bird flu wiped out so many chickens, in like 50 million chickens
free range
in a month or two? And now it's going to go to humans. So if it has the same effect on humans, the price of eggs will come down because supply and demand will even things out.
Right.
What?
So people eating eggs. You just have to hope that it
just
doesn't attack the vegans, because then it won't.
Oh, yeah, then we're all just still paying high price for eggs. Do you guys know that I have this obsession of talking about robots, right?
Me too.
Yeah, so much so that you were going to repeat the same stories from my
I wanted to, and you guys kept me from it. Now I'm going to do it anyway. Just
talk about the robots.
Cambridge University robot. They designed a robot to reproduce a very simple robot.
I did know that because we said it last week.
That's the one we talked about last week?
Yes.
Did you know?
Okay. Well, then we don't need to talk about any robots.
I don't understand so we can go how this is relevant.
It is. So Burmese pythons. You know where Burma is?
No. Yeah. I've actually heard about this. I watched a special on this.
But you know, India. Burma doesn't exist anymore, right? It's Myanmar.
Whatever.
Anyway.
Oh, that's why it went undercover.
It changed the name to
Witness Protection Program.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. Some genius brought over like one or two of them, and now they're overtaking Florida.
Overtaking is a strong word to say overtaking. What they're basically doing is
multiplying.
They're wiping out an entire ecosystem because they have no natural predator there, but they eat everything, all the way up to alligators. So they're killing everything. There's nothing killing them. They're breeding like they were rabbits, but they're not. They're snakes. And they grow super fast. Next thing, they'll be preying on children and small neighbor dogs.
Well, they will, actually.
They already have. Because they're going to run out of food, and at some point the whole cycle reverses itself and they all starve to death and we can start over. That's the way things work. That's why I'm worried about the bird flu.
Until you get to robots.
That's exactly
They never
right.
starve to death.
They don't. They don't. And as long as the sun's burning, they're going to figure out how to get power.
Which, yeah, I mean, really, it's only a matter of time before they just, like, disperse nanites that can self-reproduce to take care of the pythons. But then they become self-aware, and then they just take care of everybody.
They don't care about the pythons, because pythons are not a natural predator to robots, and they cannot sustain their life off of robot parts. So I don't think it's going to be an issue. What is the point of all this? You guys may wonder, what is the point of Burmese pythons, mutant lice, bubonic plague in Yosemite, Ebola in New York, is... We, as a race of people, humans in general, don't even get me started on the whole Chinese factory explosion that's still now catching fire and all these people are dying and all this chemicals. Nobody's saying what's exactly in that thing that blew up. What we do as humans is we defy the natural order of things. And then when it goes horribly wrong, we look for who to blame. And this is all examples of stuff going horribly wrong. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And now we have the consequences. And guess what? It's increasing at an extremely rapid rate. And I don't know what's going to happen with all of that, but I just got to tell you, your kids are going to grow up in a very different world. It's going to be a world where they're going to have to look out for mutant lice and Burmese pythons and Chinese factories blowing up and
self-reproducing, you know, robots.
Self-reproducing robots that are killing people. And I, you know, get out of my factory. That's kind of what they're saying, isn't it? You know, I got this. I can weld. All right, on to better news, bigger news. Are you ready for that?
Yep.
You're just not even with me yet, are you? You're trying to figure out where I'm going with all this, okay? No. So natural order of things gone. We're not doing it. We're not following it. We're messing everything up.
No, I'm just resisting my urge to rant about that.
Go ahead. It's a good topic. It never works.
That's why people have radio shows.
Jason?
They're like, oh, we have this bug. Let's introduce frogs. Oh, crap. Those frogs aren't from here. Nobody else eats them. Now they're overtaking everything and screwing everything up. Let's introduce cats or something else to eat those. Yes. Oh, man. Genius.
Rant all you want because it's only going to get worse. And then Jesus is going to come back, and it's all going to get better. Okay?
It's like walking into to Josie's room, and she's supposed to be laying down and sleeping, and really she's climbing on the bookshelf. That's what it's going to be like. We'll be like, oh, I want to get up now. And he'll be like, what are you guys doing?
Jesus is going to do
it. Oh, okay, I'm with you now.
We're like, we've made robots, and we sent pythons places they weren't supposed to be. And I'd be like, oh my goodness. Where's the pacifier?
And it's not the first time we've done that kind of stuff. I mean, they have issues like that on islands all over the place. And yeah, it's self-correcting, but in the meantime, the pain is great. But the whole point of all this is that when we don't follow the design, there's problems. Always problems.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about the church and operating by God's design, and whenever we don't do that, we end up with problems. Well, here's some of the problems that we end up with. In my opinion, these are problems in the church. I read an article this week, found out that Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, makes $880,000 per year.
What in the world?
$880,000. A little over $600,000 of that comes from running Samaritan's Purse, and a couple $100,000 comes from running the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. He's the only person I know that can be 2 six-figure CEOs at the same time.
That Samaritan's got a big purse.
They must, because they're paying him, you know. And I think people, they do such great work, and they give that. And he's making $880,000, and does he need to? That's the question. I don't think he needs to. I don't think he needs to at all. But however, let's just give him the benefit of the doubt and say maybe he needs to. He must have a motive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. When asked why he makes so much money for these two groups, here's his answer, quoted on some news story. He's 63, and he said he wants to make sure he has enough money to be able to work for free when he turns 70.
That, my friends, is what we call storing up for the future.
Is there a Bible verse about that?
One or two or 60, or Jesus does not talk highly of it.
It doesn't. And the question is...
So you didn't make that up?
No, I didn't make that up. That's a quote.
Wow.
Off of you thought I made that up.
Yes.
Wow. So I sent you stuff that we're going to do on the show, and you're just thinking I'm a crazy man at 3 in the morning making stuff up?
Sometimes.
Sometimes I am, but this is not one of them. This is a real story.
That was made up.
Pythons was real, too.
What a noble cause. About. He wants to be... So he's really you're just saying, well, pay me in advance for when I will be working.
You know, here's the
thing.
He's
not working for free.
Who thinks at 70 he's work still... For us. I mean, at 70, he may not even be alive at 70. That's then what? Does all the money come back?
Nah.
So they can hire somebody else that's 70 to work
family.
For free? I don't know. I don't get it. So anyway.
What's your expense list anyway? It's like when you work for free, man, like most Americans, that's their entire life's wage. I don't know.
Yeah, for a lot of people, that is as much money in 1 year as many people will make in their whole lifetime.
Right.
Many. That's and when you look at it on a world scale, that is more money than 95% of the population will make in their entire life.
Right.
Yeah. In 1 year.
Yeah.
And my question is, can he really be doing that much service to two different companies or organizations as the CEO to be that valuable, low to mid six figures for each one of them at the same time? Most CEOs that make that kind of money are full-time dedicated to one organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like I'm working part-time. I golf in the morning, I take a couple phone calls, send out an email, I'm done, that's $600,000 a year. I don't think so. All right? But this is not an unusual thing. Other people, Southern Baptist Reverend Ed Young, senior pastor at Fellowship Church in Grapevine, Texas, pulled in over $1 million, according to a 2012 Dallas television news report. And in 2013, his last year as senior pastor at Seattle's Mars Hill Church, Reverend Mark Driscoll, drew in $607,000 and had a promise of a $150,000 raise before all of the controversy and scandal caused him to have to be kicked out of that position.
$150,000 raise.
That's a lot of raise.
I never get a raise like that.
Well, you're not going to here either. You're going to continue to get the same salary you always get.
That's okay with
Actually,
me.
Actually, we're going to double it next year.
The Lord is my inheritance.
We're going to cut it in half the year after that.
Things go up and down. Why are we even talking about all this? Because we're talking about God's design.
I just say, why wait till 70 to work for free?
Me too. Why not right now? 63 is a good retirement age. Guess what? Franklin, you're retired. Work for free.
For that reason, I'm out.
Yeah. And I don't know if he's got like a number that he has to hit in order to be able to sustain a certain lifestyle.
I need
whatever.
$5 million.
All I know
bank.
Is this. It's not God's design
yeah.
for a pastor to make that much money while there are always, I don't care where you live, within 50 miles of wherever he lives, there are people who are having a hard time getting food to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you can go to sleep at night making that kind of money and not address the ever-present catastrophic issues that are in this country.
Especially as somebody who claims Christ. Like, if you're just completely...
Doing great things, man.
If you're completely of the world and that's where you dwell and don't care about Jesus or helping people or whatever, then it's probably a little easier to go to sleep at night making $500,000 or more.
Well, I know you got a better bed.
Right. Who knows? He's probably got six Craftmatic adjustable beds.
If that's what you like. I was thinking Sleep Number. Our topic. We're still continuing on pain, how it affects our spiritual life, how it affects ministry. We're going to talk about God's design, of course, some more. But, you know, we've babbled enough about snakes and viruses and robots and high salaries now that we should probably do a song and follow it with a commercial.
Song and sure. a dance. Because we like songs about snakes. And
anyway, this is a good song to get us from silly land to serious land.
Well, I mean, once we put the snake in the garden, you see what kind of trouble we had?
Right.
We should have just left the snakes at home.
Pretty much. So it's not a song, technically. It's a poem. And it's Amina Brown, and it's called...
Snake Song.
I believe it is called Baggage Check.
Baggage Check?
Should have written that down.
Great spoken word.
But I wanted to kind of start off with it because we're going to continue talking about more kind of personal effects of pain, and then we're going to move to kind of how that develops within church and whatnot, and specifically transactional relationships. And I think this song really, or this poem really discusses the origins of how people end up in unhealthy relationships.
I listen to Mary J. Blige with the best of them. Looking for a breakthrough and don't want no more drama. And I feel Jill Scott on taking long walks, letting him love me especially different, wearing my freedom around my neck, and yes, you'd think I take a leaf from Erica's apple tree, realize that life goes on and on, let him call Tyrone and quit being a bag lady. But I can't help it. My mother's mother gave her first set of luggage. The suitcase was blue with a hard, rough exterior, two thumbs on latch, opened with a metal click-clack here. My mother learned what to pack, how to go, when to leave, married at 18, became a mother bird, left to build a nest to provide for her young, plus fend for herself, so she raised me to fly. Except I inherited her luggage. Strapped in trapped to confined airline seats at the age of 4, shuttling between the homes of a mother and a father who couldn't be married anymore here. I learned to live on a little, to keep very little, to expect that love only lasts for a little, never quick to make myself at home or make my presence known. So I learned to carry these duffel bags and backpacks on my own, hoping I make it past in security while avoiding no fly zones. All of this just to get on, just to complete my fare, just to whisper into the air how life ain't fair, how you take what you get, whether straw or brick, and try to build something with it, and hope it doesn't fail you. Hope it's not too frail to withstand the ascension. Keep your tray table locked, seat in its upright position. I'm trying to find my way home, with no Toto, no Tin Man, no Scarecrow, no yellow brick road, no ruby red slippers to click, just the metal click-clack of the latch on these bags. Our hard exteriors carry broken hearts, bad advice, love unrequited, crimes committed but never indicted, and life is a trip. So we all got bags, got masks, got things in our past that we carry on our backs too heavy. Too much excess stuff can keep you from flying, can keep you from trying to be who you are, can keep you focused on your scars, narrowed in on the hurting instead of the healing part. So I had to start to unpack my bags. Forgive myself, forgive my past. Stop dragging around the things that hold me back until I only take the carry-ons that will help me carry on and finally find home.
Hey, we have free books available. One of our hosts, Dr. Tara Goodwin, has written 3 books exploring God's design for the church. The first is Disciple-Driven Church, The Coming Reformation, which is essentially what went wrong and what not to do. The second is Being the Church, Planting Faith Communities in a Postmodern World, which is essentially what to do and includes lots of testimony of the journey God has taken us on out of the traditional church structure and into the streets and desolate parts of our city. The book also includes a Bible study that you can do by yourself or a small group of friends. The third book is The Disciple Maker's Handbook, Reproduction and the Disciple-Driven Church. It is essentially how to do what to do. It's a guide for how to get started with discipleship based on lots of examples of Jesus and his disciples and what we've learned along the way. You can download all of these for free or purchase physical copies in the Sun Ministries online store at sunministries.org/buy.
So, pain, transactional relationships, this is basically part 3.
Mm-hmm.
Big topic.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, if you're in ministry, it's worth listening to because it is the core of issues. By the way, before we start, there's one serious news story that I wanted to talk about in Compton, California. Somebody has filed a class action lawsuit against the Compton School District because they are recognizing this topic of pain in life. And what they've done is they've accumulated a large number of students that have come through the Compton School District who experienced traumatic pain in their upbringing in that neighborhood. And they are saying the school district is liable because they didn't recognize and deal with it properly, even though there was an awareness that this causes great trauma and stress in people's lives. What they would do is they would take the manifestations of all of this stress, which came out as either behavior issues or learning disabilities, mm-hmm. and they just dealt with them through discipline and correction instead of helping them. So now they're being sued in a class action lawsuit. You're not going to see this on mainstream news. They're going to court to get class action status. They haven't been given that yet, but that's what they're attempting to do.
Well, I wonder what, like, on the other end of it, what accommodations would be the expectation? You know, like what?
Well, I think you'll see that secularism is going to take a secular approach. They're going to want counseling and all these things. But here's the big issue is the fact that it's going for class action status means if they're granted that, then they can pull other people into the suit all across the country and bring other school districts into the suit as being co-conspirators, perpetrators, whatever you want to call it, which means in this lawsuit has the potential to dramatically change the way the public school system operates in a way that I don't think has been seen since Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a fundamental shift. It could potentially happen. That is a long way to go before any of that occurs. Yeah. But the fact that somebody's talking about it on this level and recognizing that when you trap people in generational poverty in high crime neighborhoods and you take all of the resources out, somebody's going to be liable for the result of that. One of the kids said that the first time that he saw somebody get shot, he saw a guy get shot in the back of the head with a shotgun. He was 8 years old. And, you know, that basically changed his life. Mm-hmm. And by the time that he graduated 10 years later, he had seen 20 people shot in that time. And the school district, all they did was deal with his behavior outbursts as you're a bad kid.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not what was going on. I mean, that's just a ton of pain to endure. It's post, there's a lot of people go into combat that don't see 20 people killed in the time they're in combat. And this kid is a kid. He's not an adult.
Well, and when you, you know, sign up for the military, you know you expect, that's going to happen. When you're
sign up for kindergarten,
kid,
you don't.
Well, the other thing, like, going along, like, happening along with that is there was, I don't remember her name, probably should have looked it up if I was going to talk about it, but there was a lady that is a professor, and she wrote an article about why there are a lot of African-Americans moving to homeschooling, and she's one of them. She's homeschooling her kid. And one of the things that she mentioned was the school-to-prison pipeline, she called it.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
I was like, I don't understand what you're talking about here. But it's basically the idea is basically a result of what you're talking about in that there are people, you know, kids have more garbage dumped on them than they know how to deal with. Mm-hmm. Nobody teaching them how to deal with it. They go to a place where there's a whole bunch of other kids that don't know how to deal with it.
Right.
And an understaffed institution that doesn't know how to deal with their not knowing how to deal with it. And so they act out. And what do they get? They get suspended or they get expelled or they get whatever. Either way, they're getting punishment dumped on them, which does nothing but harden them to that whole institution, or it sends them home where, you know, just a bunch of other
hardens them to
craziness.
Authority, period.
Right. And so it's like the way that you react to those behaviors, if it's a strict punishment thing, and it's not like...
Don't we see that every day in the people we work with, in the neighborhood we're working in?
And know, so it's like that's how they react. And so it's just, it's setting them up to fail because it's punishing them. And it's not like, okay, if you do something wrong, something shouldn't happen. Not necessarily saying that, but you got to figure out the better way to interact in that situation and realize, you know, like that lawsuit's claiming is that this reaction to this is doing nothing but harming people that are already harmed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Piling on punishment on top of pain does not produce a good outcome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It just doesn't.
Yeah. And the other thing was another article I'd read was they were doing this study on what they were calling implicit bias. And they took a bunch of teachers and they gave them written descriptions of situations with students. And all they did was they changed the student's name from a like traditional white sounding name to a traditionally like black sounding name. And pretty much across the board, the teachers assessed the black student as being, they described them in like more degrading terms. They thought they were more likely to be a repeat offender, thought they were just like worse, you know, basically, and gave them more severe punishment than any of the others. And that was the only difference that they made to the situation, was they changed the kid's name.
Hmm. You know, I get really sad when I think about that situation, because we've ministered with kids, you know, that have seen more stuff by the time they're 12 than most of the adults that are out there listening to us, you know. And what really frustrates me is the blind eye that's turned. And then what manifests is the protests in the streets, which are immediately divisive. Mm-hmm. And you're on one side or the other, it seems like, for the majority of people. Very few wait to hear an outcome. They're picking sides. So then more pain's inflicted into an already painful situation, and more division between authority and those who they're supposed to protect and support. And the relationships are being trained – to be transactional. And that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And a transactional relationship doesn't solve anything. It's not the way God operates. And we're going to explain some more of that. Here's the other thing is that so they're being trained in transactional relationships, but the reality is that the authorities that we experience, and I don't want to dog the authority because God says he establishes all authority, but they come into situations dictating the ground rules for interaction.
Yep.
And then they wonder why they don't get interaction. So we've tried many times to try and build the bridge between the police and the community, and they always are like, well, you need to do this in order to help get crime down in your neighborhood. It's like, no, I don't feel like that's what we need to do. I need you guys to respond better in these situations. Well, we're doing what we can. There's no give and take mm-hmm. on methodology or, look, I may be really weird about this, but I live in my neighborhood. It's my neighborhood. It's not the city of St. Louis's neighborhood. It happens to be within the borders of the city of St. Louis. I live there. I should have a say in how crime's dealt with. I should have a say in how people are cared for. I should have a say in how the community's cared for. And that should be my right as a citizen of that community. I shouldn't have people coming in that don't live there just because they're in a paid position dictating to me how they're going to deal with things.
Yeah.
Because they don't know. They don't know who's doing what on the streets unless somebody that lives there tells them.
Right.
They're not that good at it. Yeah. Right. So to tell me how I have to communicate to them is basically saying that we only have value in their eyes when we comply with their wishes. And that's transactional.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't toe the line, then they don't want to help. They don't want to get – and we've watched this with the neighborhood ownership model in our neighborhood, mm-hmm. right? We have that, hey, if you guys need to do the neighborhood ownership model, I said, nope, I don't agree with it. I don't look at it as the way that crime needs to be dealt with. There's a lot of stuff I don't agree with, so I'm not going to do that. Then we get ignored. And then, you know, they don't interact. And it's like we're just going to punish you
right.
by neglect for not doing what we're telling you to do. And we're going to continue to do that until somebody finally says, okay, we'll do it your way. And it's yep. just a big old load of, you know what, ain't going to do that. I think what will happen is, especially in our neighborhood, is we're taking a little different approach. What we're doing is we're breaking down racism one person at a time. We're caring for people that haven't been cared for before. And we're showing them that everybody's not like that.
I was going to say, it really takes – it takes humble service and putting yourself out there. I mean, when people, like what you're talking about, like genuine care, when somebody sees that you care for them and whatever it is, meeting their needs or whatever, it's like one of our employees.
More than one. You got to see in the morning, man.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, one of our employees, you know, never worked for any white man at all ever before. And he came and worked for us and we care for him. You know, and he sees that, and we're fair, and we're empowering. And one day he says, "You know, you guys are awesome. You broke down all of my stereotypes and whatever my preconceived ideas."
And all we did because we didn't transact with him,
right?
I mean, we did in the economic way because hey, you're going to come to work, and we're going to pay you a certain amount of wage in order to do that. But on every other level, we didn't,
right?
Because
we were just straightforward.
What's really fun is walking into that cafe kitchen now for me because I go back there. You know, there's a half a dozen people there that we've impacted their lives, and they know it. And we've not asked for anything above and beyond show up and be a good employee, but there's a lot of other stuff we've been able to do for them. And they just feel a lot of love coming out of there towards me. And when I first moved into the neighborhood, I didn't feel a lot of love. And I'm like, this actually can work.
Yeah.
Lay down your privilege. Come invest in the people that have been oppressed. Don't side with the oppressor automatically just because it's the authority that's been set up. You can stand back and you can ask God, you know, where's the injustice and where do I stand? Because all of it comes from God. All justice comes from God. And do that repeatly and don't transact with people.
Well,
just show love.
I think that when people see you're putting your heart forward, they're met with a choice. They're met with a choice of I can do the same thing and open myself up or I cannot. And that's what Jesus did. And that's what we've had to face whenever we see, hey, he died on the cross.
Exactly right. So we're going to continue on this transactional relationship thing. The world systems are set up and based in transactional relationships. So all this stuff we're talking about with authority and with the city. And I mean, you think about it, go all the way down to we have found that whenever we complain about neglect in our neighborhood, it gets addressed. So when we report things to CSB and we report stuff to the political unit that's responsible for it, it does get addressed. We haven't had too many situations where we've just been told, you know, forget it, it ain't going to happen. It's happened a couple times. But for the most part, that responsible entity takes care of the problem. Mm. The problem that I see in that is it's transactional, because unless I'm complaining, they ain't doing it.
Mm.
You know, they're not doing it on their own. For the most part, they're waiting for someone to step in and say, because they're spread thin and they're going to put the resources where the complaints are. And that's a transactional thing. In order to get me to quit complaining, they're going to come take care of that problem.
Yeah.
And, right. and really, that's their responsibility to take care of it anyway. Now, some of the departments, they take care of stuff and there are only certain things they're going to do, and that's as far as they can go. And I understand all that. But it's like a streetlight thing. You know, we had 48 or 6 or whatever streetlights out in our little neighborhood, and there were people that were being paid really good money to make sure that those were all taken care of.
Right.
And they just weren't doing it.
Yep.
And then whenever we turned it in, I got, you know, backlash from the person. What are you trying to do? Get me fired? Well, I mean, honestly, it probably wouldn't hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
Because you ain't doing your job anyway, and you're sucking a huge payroll out of the community.
And you say you're doing your job.
Yeah. Right. Well, you talked anyway. About that last week, about the being trained into transactional relationships, right. And it's like, that's just another thing, you know. It's just, think daily life. It's like, you got kids, job, school, whatever it is, and it's like, got enough stress of just regular, very normal, healthy human activity, and it's like, that's the last thing you need is somebody's who tells everybody, okay, I'm the one in charge of whatever, I'm the responsible thing, I'm taking care of whatever, whether it's a city or a boss or a cop or the manager at McDonald's, whatever it is. And you have to then, in order to get any result, you have to then transact with them.
Right.
Because if you don't do that, nothing happens. And all it does is then it just hits you while you're already frustrated. And yeah, it's just repeated stuff like that. It's like, it's going to be really hard to differentiate that from your other human interactions.
So our accountant filed a wrong form. I'm pretty sure this is what this is about, but I don't know for sure. Got a call from the IRS. Went to my voicemail, and it said, it was recording, and it said, you have an important matter with the Internal Revenue Service, and you need to call them before the close of business today. Here's your whatever number, transaction number. So I'm trying to do a bunch of other stuff, so I call them, and I'm 20 minutes on hold, and I'm late for an appointment, and I got the thing on speaker, and I'm walking out, and I'm driving in the car with the thing on speaker. I'm on hold, listen to their music, and their, we love, you know, we value you, stay on the line. And finally, I'm just like, I got to do something else, so I hang up. So I get done with that, and I go back to my office, and I dial them again. Second call, 50 minutes. Nobody answers the phone. I finally said, if you want me to call you back today, that's 70 minutes on hold that I've invested in, and you're threatening that I got to call you today or else something, and not even telling me what it is. I'm just going to take my chances that it ain't going to be that bad. I can't do it. Yeah. You know, and there they are, pressing down that authority on, you know, that's abusive to me. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do that, then you should answer your phone. If you're going to call me, leave me a message and say, we're the IRS, you have to call us today. Even though I know we haven't done anything wrong enough that's going to cause us any great grief, still, I was trying to be compliant, and I can't comply. And too many transactional systems don't allow you to comply. They're very one-sided. They're very lopsided, and authorities press down, and that's what Jesus said, the way the Gentiles rule.
Mm-hmm.
The penal system is transactional. The workplace is transactional. Academia is transactional. So we navigate a world of transactions, but real love is not transactional. Transactional relationships are based on trade, or as you put it last week, Jason, they're economic relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just wanted to explain that a little more.
But not yet. We're going to do it because we're going to have to go to the next song.
Well, you talk about the song because it's your song.
Which one? Million Pieces?
Yep.
Is that what we're doing? The Newsboys, Million Pieces. I didn't have to talk about it because everybody can listen to the words of this and realize that whatever is in your way, pain of your past, you really want to get to the other side of it. Because when it happens, it's just like a million pieces fall away. So, Ollie, let's do the song and then the commercial break, and we'll be back on the other side to talk about economic transactional relationships.
Feel like God is calling you to a life of full-time ministry, but not in a traditional church setting?
Are you looking for real training in real-life situations without the high cost of many Bible colleges?
Hello, I'm Dr. Terry Goodwin. I'm the founder of Sun Ministries and one of your hosts on the Resistance Radio Show. Sun Ministries is now offering a no-cost one-year urban missions training course centered in North St. Louis. This one-year certificate course places you into an active and unique urban ministry setting where you will work and learn alongside full-time working missionaries to America. Your time is split between working in one of the ministry business settings and non-traditional training sessions. Room and board is provided for students as a part of the program. You will learn hands-on from people that do urban ministry every day. The coursework has been developed in the field and focuses on your ability to make disciples and minister to the hurting. You will be trained and equipped for a lifetime of service to God in ways that college can't even begin to do. The teaching topics are personal and relevant, the setting is real and active, and the work being done here is an amazing move of God in our midst.
If God has placed His call on your life, you need to investigate this opportunity. Space is limited and only a few will be chosen this year. To find out more, visit us on the web at www.sunministries.org or write to us at Sun Ministries, 1515 Newhouse Avenue, St. Louis, Missouri, 63107.
So we were talking about transactional relationships, and see how I'm talking funny now. It's getting bad. Basically, that is where we trade something to get something. It's an economic relationship, and I cut Jason off and told him he couldn't talk about it until we got back from the break, and we're back, and now you get to talk about it.
I'm here now. So here is – I just wanted to elaborate because I do that. So basically, the thing that I see when I look at transactional relationships is that you have love or you have a transactional relationship. They do not intersect. So they leave no room or cause or need for love. There's just no opportunity for it. So just like an economic exchange, and last week we talked about, you know, $1.50 for a candy bar or whatever, just like an economic exchange, transactional relationships are based on equal exchange, based on expectations, logic, weights and measures, however you want to word it. So, you know, when the worker at the drive-thru hands you your burger, Mark, I'm sorry, it's not because she loves you. It's because you paid the business for the food, and the business paid her to
sometimes
hand it.
I would disagree with that.
To you, right? So everybody's getting paid. Well, it's not because
I was convinced it was always because they were after his curls. He was completely bald, and he would tell him that. Are you after my curls?
Anyway, your grandpa might have been.
He was a little,
mildly insane.
He was a little bit crazy.
Now, if it was Evan, yes,
he was a great man.
They're always after his curls. So it's because you paid the business for the food, and the business paid her, right? So it's all fair. Everyone has. Oh my goodness, she's waving signs at me. Everyone has clear expectations all around, and love does not work that way, right? It's not an employer-employee relationship. And we were talking earlier about how we're trying to interact with our employees, and most people look down on businesses who run things on a strict, emotionless employer-employee interaction, you know, because we want businesses who will pay attention to the fact that their employees and their customers are humans.
And I found out that I'm an intimidating interviewer.
Yes, you did.
And apparently, and I don't follow any of the rules. I basically just say, I need an answer out of you. Tell me how much money you need to make. And they're like,
right now.
They're like, and I'm like, well, I mean, seriously, if you go to a job interview, you should understand how much money you want to make.
You should.
And you should know that, answer that question. Or you should at least say, I want to think about it. But anyway, so what was going on and what has been going on as we're hiring these people to help us manage is they're approaching me in their trained behavior of transaction.
Yeah. Mm.
And I'm telling them, if you want to come in, and now I'm telling them, if you want to come interview with me, you're going to give me a resume and a salary requirement before I interview with you. If you're not going to do that, I'm not going to interview you. And they don't, they're like, oh, how do we negotiate? Well, we're not. I'm not a salary negotiator. Tell me how much money you need to live, okay? Because if you're going to come and assess my job and then say, oh, in order to do that, I need this much money, I don't want to hire you. Because then every time something else needs done, you're going to be evaluating whether you're getting paid enough for it or not. And that creates bad attitude. Mm-hmm. What I want you to say is, this is the course God has me on, and that's how much I need in order to make a living. Mm-hmm. So let's see if that comes together in a confluence. And you had some serious interactions.
I'll get in. Yeah, I don't know if I got time for that before.
We'll do it after the hour. I was trying to set you up.
No, I think maybe I can.
You only got 3.5 minutes, so.
Yeah.
Talk fast.
We will. So, okay. So, yeah. So, basically, the reality of our wood shop is that I'm the one running it with very little help, and we have very big orders coming up and that are coming up sooner than I would like. And so, just a lot of stress, and I have to manage, and I'm not really the best manager in the world. It's not my first inclination. And so, it's just been really hard on me just try to figure it out. And so, we've been had a call one of our customers and say, look, I might not be able to get your stuff done, but I called our other customer, and they're like, oh, push it back a month. I'm having issues. And I was like, oh, my goodness. And like, really, I was under so much like stress and emotional, whatever. Like, it was, I just, you know, God was like tapping on my shoulder, and he was, I just felt like he squished me into a little bitty bug. And then he's like, hey, I'm really big. This is mine. So quit freaking out about it. And I was like, okay, God, yay, I'm going to trust you. And I felt really good. And then that night, after we interviewed those guys in the morning, found out that neither of them would work out for some issues. And I just felt like someone just kicked me right in the stomach. And I was like, wow, really, God? Like, I actually had some relief come, and now I don't, because I had my hope set on my, you know, help, some skilled help. And yeah, my initial emotional reaction was like, I'm just overwhelmed. And then I was, you know, mad at God because he didn't have answers for me, and I didn't have answers, and all this work coming up. And I was like, I don't know how to get this done. I can't ever figure out how to get it done. And I had some options, and none of those options are working out. So what the heck? And it was right after I assured both my customers that their orders would be just fine. So I was like, oh, great. But then after being upset, then I was assumed that basically the wood shop having trouble was because there was something wrong with me. You know, we talked about that last week.
Which is just not true.
And that God was showing me, that there's something wrong with me by not allowing our wood shop to actually succeed. And so my wife, being the great, great, lovely wife that she is, she's like, we should probably pray. And I'm like, fine.
All right,
fine. But I did. It really wasn't too happy about it. And then I sat on the couch and like pouted for like an hour. And then God was like, okay, seriously, what the heck? And I'm like, you're right. You know, this is your deal, and whatever it is, it's yours. And you know much better than what I do. And so it took me well over an hour and a half to get over my little kindergarten fit, and you know, actually be like, okay, God, I do trust you. This is your deal, and you're in control, and you can figure it out, because I definitely can't. But that whole lack of trust, which is what it was found on my own pain, my own struggles with relationship and trust. And my struggles to really believe that God's good and that he cares for me and he loves me. And I lose sight of that frequently because of the pains of my past and how I chose to react to that pain. And so my initial assumption is, in the face of negative stuff, is to assume that God's mad at me or that something's wrong with me and he's trying to fix it. And I have to catch myself and be like, no, God is actually good. He is actually healing me and growing me. And it is his thing. And then in the morning, basically, I just got some clarity that God was protecting me from people we shouldn't hire.
Yeah.
So it was all an act of God's protection that I was really uncomfortable with. The Resistance is hosted by Dr. Terry Goodwin, Mark Sanford, Jason Callahan, and Mark Goodwin. Our theme music is The Resistance by Josh Garrels and is licensed by Marmoset Music. This episode of The Resistance Radio Show was originally broadcast live on KXEN 1010 AM in St. Louis, Missouri.
Thank you for being a part of The Resistance. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or directly from our feed at theresistanceradioshow.wordpress.com. Find us on Twitter at Disciple Driven, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Disciple Driven Church, or on our website at disciplechurch.org. To learn more about our missionary work in the inner cities of America, please visit sunministries.org. You can email us directly at terry@disciplechurch.org.